a very old FAA-generated video with an aircraft, and they demonstrate that if you have the separation of charge that Leslie refers to as being the rubber tire filled with a nitrogen fill to keep it from having corrosion issues, that the movement of gasoline through the pump can actually cause the a spark to occur between the pump nozzle and the aircraft itself, and that would be a generation, a way to generate the spark that he was been talking about. And the way to prevent that, of course, is to have a wire that attaches from the pumping truck to the aircraft and another wire from the pumping truck to a designated and approved ground receptacle piece of wire with like a rebar into the ground, but it's not rebar, it's something special.
Okay, that's very interesting, Hank. I had no idea that it was that complicated, that you have to keep things at ground potential during pumping airplane fuel. They still use leaded gas in small planes to this day, don't they?
Well, there's no replacement, unfortunately. The unleaded gasolines or fuels that are coming out don't have the same characteristics at altitude, and so you end up with fuel that may or may not gel or have other difficulties. You know, there's something called re-vapor pressure, and that's how you measure the amount of volatility of a gasoline. And it just makes it very difficult to come up with the right answer, which is why leaded fuels, which are known to be carcinogenic, continue to have an exemption from the EPA for use in aircraft.
That's very interesting. And jet fuel is sort of just glorified kerosene, right?
Well, it is kerosene. It's just fire. Let me rephrase. It has a greater amount of distillation for refining out paraffins. Paraffins tend to burn at higher temperatures. So basically, jet fuel, diesel fuel, kerosene, all these things are of the same stock.
Oh, okay. I always thought that it was more difficult to set diesel on fire than kerosene.
It might be, but it's not much more.
Okay. Like I said, I've been watching the M1 Abrams tank, and it's designed to take all three of those fuels, probably others.
Well, one of the reasons we use turbine-powered helicopters for during the Cold War was that any fuel you could get, including gasoline, which the aircraft could run on. Of course, the temperatures, the exhaust gas temperatures, all go up when you use something that's more highly refined like gasoline than something like jet fuel. So, you know, in time of war, they don't really care about it. In time of peace, it's a big issue.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of thought that goes into all the things that we take for granted. I mean, one of the things they pointed about the Abrams tank is it's not only a matter of what kind of fuel can you get, but it sort of depends upon the environment that you're running the tank. If you're running the tank in the middle of Siberian winter, you probably would want to use kerosene rather than diesel, which would have a bigger chance of things kind of gelling up the engine.
Now, that's called poor point suppression, and it's one of the things that differentiates all the jet fuels that are out there. For civilian, we have Jet A and Jet B. For the military, they've got JP4, is the standard. There is a JP1 and then JP2, and there's all the way up to I think the SR-71 required some JP-38 or whatever the heck the specialized number was for that aircraft because it had such extremes of temperature under which it would burn.
Okay, very good. I mean, all this is fascinating. It's amazing how many different nooks and crannies are just full of important information that most of us, unfortunately, don't even think about. We just go about our lives, but there are reasons and solutions to problems that we don't even know existed.
Because we hang out at standard temperature and pressure.
STP.
Most of us do if we're lucky.
But you know, even up until the 80s, if you lived up in the mountains of Colorado, you could get gasoline that was specifically formulated for higher altitude use. It was a, believe it or not, a lower octane fuel for use at high altitude.
Okay, that's interesting. The only thing I really knew about Colorado and its barometric pressure was that plasma televisions, which were very popular for about an hour and a half, I actually have one in my living room, do not work well in places like Colorado because the pressure in the plasma didn't take well to the barometric pressure of the environment.
If I can go slightly off topic for a second, we have an organization you've all heard of called the EPA, and they went after this Volvo car dealer up in the mountains, a place called Leadville, Colorado, and the Volvo car dealer was installing an aircraft type mixture control, the type that was user adjustable in cars, and he did it so that the cars would actually run on the fuel you could get at altitude where this guy had his customers. And the EPA was afraid that cars that were modified by him at altitude would find their way down for use at sea level and therefore pollute. And it was sort of an interesting case of one agency having a little more authority than perhaps common sense.
Well, the government and common sense have always had a problem getting along.
All right, thanks for letting me talk. N1YDY.
So the next one is a square wave still considered to be DC?
Again, I think we covered this. Unfortunately, no, it's not. It's a special case.
So how would you describe this special case?
I would call it a square wave, and leave it at that. It's not quite a DC because it's changing, although it's not changing direction, it's changing amplitude, and so it becomes a special case where if you just kind of lump it in with, usually when people are talking about direct current, they're not just discussing that the current direction is going back and forth, but that the amplitudes are changing over time. Most DC circuits, at least when I think of DC circuits, have a relatively constant voltage level. Square waves obviously do not.
VDH with a comment.
Certainly, John.
Well, a square wave can have a DC level. Is it talking about a square wave that reverses polarity?
I think he's not talking about one that reverses polarity. The one that goes from zero to some value and then back to zero.
Both cases, but both cases apply.
That was a triple. Wesley, you want to repeat yourself? Because at one point I was talking, you were talking, and I think John was making some comment towards the end of it.
Okay, right. So, in other words, a pulse which is zero and positive going with a 50% duty cycle, like, say, a 1 kilohertz where it's half a millisecond positive voltage, half a millisecond zero, half a millisecond positive, half a millisecond zero. Go ahead.
Well, it applies to both. Positive, negative, or positive, and to zero. So signal to be considered DC should never change. Right away.
Well, if it's a square wave that's going positive and negative, let's say it's plus 10 volts for half a millisecond, and then minus 10 volts for half a millisecond as a 1 kilohertz square wave, so it is changing polarity. So it is going positive and negative.
Yes, but if we take a square wave that never goes below zero, zero up whatever the voltage and then zero up, it's still not DC because it does have a leading edge and falling edge. The square wave is not a sinusoidal periodic waveform in which the amplitude alternates at a steady frequency between peaks, medium, No, on the fixed maximum and minimum values, which with the same duration at minimum and maximum. So the idea of square waves, the transition between the minimum and maximum are instantaneous. But still, the main requirement for DC is never change. If it's any changes, it does contain the AC components. Am I right or wrong?
Yes, if it is changing, it has an AC component. I mean, as an example, take a square wave. Let's say it's at 1 kilohertz. Okay, the period is 1 millisecond. So if it spends a half a millisecond at 10 volts and half a millisecond at 0 volts, okay, that is a 1 kilohertz signal. But you can think of it as a square wave of 5 volts with DC added to it. A square wave that's plus 5 for half a millisecond, minus 5 for half a millisecond, plus 5 volts of DC. That'll bring it up to 0 to 10.
It's a very good point. If not some addition to it. But before that, the period of the square wave is measured which way? How do we measure that?
Of the time for one cycle. Identify similar points on the waveform, and if you keep your fingers that far apart on the waveform, where the waveform does the same thing again, that's the time for one cycle, the period.
Absolutely right. Absolutely agree. So, we were thinking about what is it? Is a square wave DC or is AC? And we have two situations. One situation is that you have a physical switch or button or the telegraphic key, da-da-da, da-da-da, and then you have a DC connected to it. My question is, how did waveform differ from the ideal square wave, which an amplitude of 1 can be represented as infinite sum of sinusoidal waves? The ideal square wave contains the only component of all integral harmonic frequencies. What is the difference between those two?
Well, if you have a square wave, let me see if I have the repeater. I don't know if you're... can you copy me, Wes?
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay. Well, if you have a square wave which is changing, I mean, the very fact that it is going positive and negative, like you say, it can be, it has an AC component. We're used to thinking of AC as being a sine wave because that's the easiest waveform to generate with rotating machinery. But AC can be a triangle wave, a square wave, or a pulse waveform going positive. It's all AC if it is time varying. Go ahead.
Dr. Roy, any comments?
No, I think John is making the point. It's kind of almost a linguistic one. It sort of depends upon your definition. If you take the direct current as not indicating a change in direction, but simply a change in amplitude, then everything other than a constant voltage is alternating current.
He's excellent. He's excellent. That's why I'm really targeting him. Let me drop. Okay. All repetitive waveforms can be composed of a combination of many sinusoidal waves. So any waveform can be analyzed and determined by component devices. That was Fourier analysis. So now we're talking about square wave or rectangular wave. Really not a DC at all. It is a combination of a number of sine waves. And you would like to compare it to the single switch, when you have a DC. What is the difference between those two? You see on your oscilloscope, if you don't go to the analysis, a square wave and a square wave. How do you know which one is which?
I'll pick it up, Roy.
Go ahead, go ahead.
Okay, well, I mean, the whole idea of the square wave, as you say, it can be resolved into a series of harmonically related sinusoids. But again, it's still a C. But Fourier series also includes the DC term. In other words, it's DC plus a series of harmonically related sinusoids. So a waveform, if it's raised up off the zero line, then it could have a DC component. Just as you said, like a square wave going from 0 to 10, you can resolve that into a square wave going plus 5, minus 5, plus 5 volts of DC to bring it up. So there can be a DC component.
That's right, they can. So in other words, is we don't look deep, we may see two waveforms, one with DC battery and a key, simple key on it. And that would be square wave when we close the key and open up the key. And the other one could be made from sinusoidal signal. And we may have a third one, even the third one, the product of rectifier, the grace bridge for diet. And we may think it's DC. And we may think it does have a DC component. So at least one of those doesn't have a DC component. Because if we spread that rectangle, spread that square wave, we see a number of sinusoidal waves. So it's a false DC. Right or wrong?
Well, yeah, I agree with you that the square wave can be decomposed into the harmonically related sinusoids. I agree with that. That's for Fourier series. I'm not sure exactly what the question is, but as I say, I agree that in fact that's the principle of Fourier series, that any periodic waveform, any waveform that repeats, can be decomposed into harmonically related sinusoids. Go ahead.
The question was, is that last example that you explained, having a DC component, if only you see the tops of the sinusoids that make the 10 volts or let's say 5 volts plus part of square wave that looks like DC, is it really DC?
Well, if it's changing, if it's time varying, it must have an AC component in it. For example, like if you take a sine wave, let's say you run it through a half wave rectifier, you know, then you get just the top half of the sine wave and then zero, and then the top half of the sine wave and then zero. You don't get the negative half of the cycle. That waveform can be decomposed into a DC level, which is usually, I think, Vmax over pi, plus a series of harmonically related sinusoids. So, yeah, even the process of doing a half-wave rectification, where you take a half-wave sinusoid and you rectify it, you get the positive half and then the zero. You know what I mean by the half-wave. That waveform, which is periodic, it has a DC level now, and it also has a series of harmonically related sinusoids in it. Go ahead.
Okay, I agree with that.
Okay, that was just to straight up some of the myths. Because sometimes you are looking at the square wave and you don't know what the square wave was created from. A whiff. And because of the way that your oscilloscope presents it to you, you may not know how many of AC components it is in there, or odd harmonics, or whatever the products in it. But it was just a science section, and I believe it's the time right now for Space Report. It's 2:26.
Anyway, thank you, Wes. Thank you, John. You know, waves, wave equations are linear equations, and linear equations can be deconstructed. So you can take a complex wave and reduce it to a large number of the sinusoidal components with different frequencies and different amplitudes, and tack on the DC offset if necessary. So Fourier transform is an interesting concept. There's a variant called fast Fourier transforms, which are just little mathematical tricks to improve the speed and efficiency of computation. Anyway, thanks everyone for all of this. It was fascinating, and I hope people enjoyed it. And now, as Wesley pointed out, it's 10:26, time for the SpaceNet Report with Paul WS2N.
AC2GS WS2N for the SpaceNet Report for the TechNet. Thanks for good topics tonight. And last week when I was talking about Starship taking off, it was supposed to take off the following day. It was going to be on a Monday. So what happened was they got down to a few seconds, and they realized that they had a problem with one of the valves. It was not opening all the way. Anyway, they scrubbed on Monday, and they transferred it over to Thursday. So sure enough, Thursday, 400-foot, almost 400-foot combination of a super heavy booster and Starship, when it was put together, it's higher than the Saturn V, higher than the Space Launch System. And it's got 33 engines attached to it. Now you compare that to the engines that Falcon 9 has. Falcon 9 has 9, but when they launch off 3 at one time on a Falcon Heavy, it's 27 engines. And the difference between the engines is the new Raptor engines on the Starship are twice as powerful as the Merlin engines on Falcon 9. So Falcon 9 is putting out roughly 250,000 pounds of thrust. This thing's 500,000 pounds of thrust on each engine. And they have a ring of them, 13 engines on the inside and 20 engines on the outside, adding up to 33 engines. It all had to go well. They were hoping that they can get off the launch pad with this thing, it was going to be considered a success. It runs on liquid methane, liquid oxygen, compared to most of the rocket engines, which are usually RP1, which is a refined kerosene. Talk about kerosene, it's just an extra filtered type of kerosene that's flying the rockets like Falcon 9. But this thing's methane, liquid methane. They always list it as CH4. And sure enough, it got down to zero. It's roughly 9:30 in the morning Eastern Standard Time. They counted it down. And sure enough, it took off. People in Hawthorne, California were going nuts. That's where Mission Control is for SpaceX. And, they had quite a crowd there. I'm amazed how many young people are up in that crowd. So it's a very good group. And sure enough, it took off. The engines ignite, and it takes a few seconds before the vehicle actually starts to rise off the van, and it did slowly rise off the van. And sure enough, about five or six engines looked like they were out. They had a graph there, and you could tell around five of them were out operating. But the computers and everything compensate for it. The engines, the internal engines, certain engines on the inside have gimbling mechanisms, the ones on the outside don't. So it adjusted itself for the proper flight to roll over and headed out over the Gulf of Mexico. This thing launched from Boca Chica, Texas, which is where called Starbase is located. And it took off. Looked like it was doing rather well, and they were hoping for the Super Heavy booster to separate from the Starship. Plans in the future would be for the Super Heavy booster to actually do a boost back and come back to where it took off from and land exactly where it took off from. The Starship itself would eventually come back through the atmosphere and also land, back at Boca Chica, Texas. But this flight was planned on having the booster splash down, you might say, in the Gulf of Mexico, which was the plan for the booster, which actually wound up eventually happening to both vehicles. Both vehicles did not separate. You could see them rolling around, and high in the atmosphere. I think they got around 50 or 60 miles up, but eventually the FTS system was ignited. The FTS is the flight termination system. Before they launch, they load the booster and the Starship up with explosives. Sure enough, they did do that. They don't want this thing coming down on land somewhere, and when they start to go out of control, that's what happens. It either happens autonomously or mission control pushes the button. I don't know which they used on this one. But it was considered a success if they could get this monster off the launch pad. They were going to be happy. Elon Musk has five or six more of these things getting ready to roll out of the rocket factory down in Boca Chica, Texas. Plan on doing the exact same thing, maybe two or three months from now, and we'll get a chance to watch it again. Right now, you can see the whole presentation, this whole launch on the SpaceX website. Go to spacex.com, and sure enough, there's different choices. You can bring up different rockets, different things that they do. And the first one that you bring up is Starship. And if you click on that, you can get the YouTube as if it happened, a complete recording from launch until the flight termination system. And then they go off the air. But very well done. People at SpaceX are going to be anxious trying to get this thing to, commit for the next flight, which would be... if they do it, it's going to be a duplication. The idea is to have the Super Heavy booster come down, crash into the Gulf of Mexico, and Starship would continue on, not a complete orbit around the Earth, but it would go just north of Hawaii and come back through the atmosphere. They plan on evaluating that. They have all kinds of telemetry from this, so they'll know what it's doing. The idea is they call it belly flopping. It's going to come down there. It has adjustable wings in front and back, and it will try to control itself as far as it can, all the way down to near the water, and eventually that's where that flight will end. And then they said the third flight as well is not going to be orbital, but the fourth one will. That's the present plan, but of course they change their mind quite regularly at SpaceX. We'll see what happens. Any questions or comments for this topic? This is WS2N.
WB2BXL.
Good evening, Frank. WB2BXL. WS2N. Did you see this thing fly?
Yeah, I'm a retired guy. Do a little freelance work, but for the most part, retired. So I did get to watch it live at 9:30 Friday morning. Probably much to my wife's annoyance, who wanted to watch Only Murders in the Building or something. Anyway, sort of watched at least part of Scott Manley's analysis of it and Elliot Space with Tim Dodd and a couple of them. I wonder if you watched any of those. It sounds to me like the YouTubers feel most of the problem was actually with their Stage Zero, which is SpaceX talk for the launch pad. And apparently they tried to launch this thing from a concrete launch pad, which in retrospect does not sound like it makes a heck of a lot of sense, since the flame from all those engines kind of blew out all the concrete. The engines apparently adjusted the concrete, and that's why some of them didn't work. And I think it was Tim Dodd who thought that perhaps the reason staging didn't work, stage separation, was because the latches were damaged by all the concrete flying around at, after launch. But I know they did pretty well, I guess. They got to 39 kilometers, which I guess is about 128,000 feet. I guess about Mach 2.5 or something. But it certainly looked too slow when it launched. And watching this thing going, I'm like, okay, I don't think this thing's going to make it. It's too slow. Didn't look like enough fire. They probably don't have enough engine for it. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I thought there was like three of them out. And then I heard up to six of them out. Yeah, it did rise slow off the pad. I noticed that as well. I haven't listened to Scott Manley's report yet or Tim Dodd. I know Tim Dodd is really invested in this thing. He's got a ticket to ride on one of these things in the future. They picked him to go. But so yeah, I'm sure he's paying very close attention to what's going on. Yeah, I see this concrete orbit launch mount that they use, all piping and everything, it goes up, and it looks like from below you've got a million different pipes connected to all the different engines. So, you're saying maybe the blast was knocking the concrete and then knocked out the engines, and then the stuff flew up high enough where it could affect the latching mechanism between the second stage and the first stage. I don't know about that. I guess it's possible. So, they're going to work it all out. They plan on putting a lot extra fire protection, but, you know, a water suppression system, more than what they had down there, which they said that alone is going to take a month or two to install. So they have plans on that. I guess that'll help with whatever problems they're having with concrete flying all over. But that was the plan eventually to do anyway. They just wanted to see if this thing would work. If they didn't want to wait for a bigger water suppression system. We'll see. I'll bring up Scott Manley and Tim Dodd's report. I will do that, Frank.
Yeah, very good. It's kind of interesting. It sounds to me like, obviously, these folks are guessing that at this point. That may not turn out to be the cause of the staging problem. I don't think staging is normally done with latches anyway. I think NASA uses explosive bolts for that. And I believe on this one, the STS, the flight termination system, was done on the ground the way NASA does it. I don't think they did an automated one like the Falcon 9 do, but it could be wrong on that. But the consensus seems to be that they use the STS to terminate the flight once it started tumbling and they no longer had their control over it. Anyway, they made it past Max 2 and Nico, which is apparently pretty good for first flight. Don't hold me to this. I think Scott Manley pointed out, or one of the YouTubers pointed out, that the Gemini Titan, the modified Titan ICBM used for Gemini, the first few attempts before they put money on it, used that as an orbital class booster, failed. It didn't make it past Max Q. I think I read somewhere they had to do some they had to upgrade the material to get it to work. And of course, the Falcon 9 failed any number of times. So this is not at all unexpected. We'll see who else has comments. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay. Okay, Frank. And, the Titans were the ICBMs, and they decided to use them for the Gemini missions. So they had to qualify them to be human rated. But I would say most rockets failed, except for the Saturn 4B and the Saturn 5. Those did not fail. They had some, the engine might quit on one of them, but they didn't explode like this. But yeah, a lot of them have had problems. Recently, Firefly didn't make it to orbit. First flight, ABL tried to launch, didn't work out for them. What's the other one now? Astra, they've given up with their rocket. They tried three times up in Kodiak, Alaska, and a fourth time down in Launch Complex 16 in Florida. And they really haven't made it. None of them put a satellite in space. First rockets are always said to be hard. Relativity now with the Terran 1 got off the launch pad, beautiful flight, but again separation problems. And you mentioned the what NASA uses, they have these frangible explosive systems where the whole circumference of this thing is wired to, bolts ignite, and this separates the, it opens up completely all the way around, and that's how they do it for their second stage to get it off by itself. And same with the expendable boosters as well, Delta 4 and Delta 2, which are now retired. They have that kind of system. When SpaceX has some kind of latching system, that once released, there's no explosive bolts that use pneumatic systems. They said air pressure, but I think it's nitrogen. What I read about their system. So I'm assuming they're doing the same with Starship. I know they do that with Falcon 9. We'll see. We'll follow this. Any other comments? Uh, Okay, I don't know if anybody's been following the Japanese Hokuto mission, Hokuto R Mission 1, they call it. It's really by a private company from Japan. I've talked about this on the net before, too. And last week they got into a lower orbit around the moon. Hokuto is a landing spacecraft. It's supposed to land on the moon Tuesday. So this Tuesday, I think it's around 12 o'clock or so. I'll have to look to see which website has this. They'll probably have the coverage on one of the YouTube stations. We'll find it. It's built by a company called iSpace. iSpace builds the Hokuto landers. It's the first of many to come. And if successful, it'll be the first time a private company and another, in this case, another country, besides the United States, China, and Russia, to actually land on the moon. Israel tried it not too long ago. We covered that on the net. I thought they were going to make it, but they did not. I believe their spacecraft got turned around 180 degrees when it was supposed to be slowing down. They started to accelerate, hit the surface of the moon at 500 miles an hour. And then India had a problem as well. But they want to crash against the moon. But I think this one is going to make it. I really do. I've read a lot about it. I went to the iSpace website a couple times, and it gave me an idea of how they plan on going about it. And it should be good. It's not a massive thing. I mean, it's probably about 6.5 feet by 6.5 feet, roughly. Got four legs that fold down, and it'll land on four legs, similar to what the Lems did when they landed on the moon. Surveyors had three legs, but all the six Lems that landed on the moon all had four legs, and they copied that idea. Hopefully it works out. If it does, there are on board, there's two small rovers, I mean very small, maybe in the probably 20-pound category, and the two of them that are supplied, as far as I know, are both coming from the UAE, United Arab Emirates, put these things on board. So hopefully they get to drive away and they have cameras. Maybe we'll get a good picture of what Hokuto looks like sitting on the moon's surface. Japan's heavily invested in this. They plan on eventually sending supplies, materials to the moon. Involved with now with the Artemis program as well with NASA. So just like NASA has private or governmental companies sending up cargo vehicles to the International Space Station to supply food and clothes and scientific experiments. Japan was heavily involved with that. They sent over the years 9 different spacecraft, usually around one a year, to the International Space Station. Thousands of pounds, no, literally thousands of pounds, probably around 12,000 pounds of material on each flight. They are now presently building a bigger vehicle that could not only do that for the International Space Station, but they plan on flying the Gateway Space Station once that's built around the moon. They have plans on sending unmanned craft to the moon to send supplies to who's ever on that station. And now with companies like iSpace from Japan, they could help NASA if NASA successfully starts to build some kind of a base. Their plans are planning on going to the south pole of the moon. Sure enough, companies like iSpace will be able to do the same. Instead of sending it to the International Space Station or the Gateway Space Station around the moon, they'll be sending it directly to locations on the moon where NASA and European Space Agency and Canada, they're all tied into one another, will supply material for possible base on the moon. Any comments? Oh, okay, but I'll be seeing how this thing lands, if it lands 1,000-pound spacecraft, see if it makes it on Tuesday. I hope it does, because if it's successful, they have a lander 2, Pluto 3, 4, all the way up to, I think they've got 9 land, so every now and then they'll be sending another one of these things to the moon. Not the only ones planning on sending landers to the moon, but they are by far the closest in being able to do that. You might remember a while back the Google $30 million prize. Google planned on giving away all kinds of money to a company, a private company, that could actually land a vehicle on the moon. It was supposed to take HD quality pictures and then take off again, fly 1,500 meters away from wherever they landed, land again, and take more pictures. If you did that, you know, you were going to get the Google prize. And this was supposed to happen by 2017, and there were at least 10 or 12 companies involved in trying to do this. None of them made it. None of them made the date. You were supposed to launch by the end of 2017 or something. But one of the companies was this company, iSpace, and Google dropped the prize money. They didn't care. They were full blast. They plan on doing this, you know, no matter what. I'm glad to see they kept at it. It's iSpace. Any comments? Okay, nothing hard. Anyway, was it yesterday? Cygnus, another cargo vehicle attached to the International Space Station, separated from the International Space Station, then probably coming back to Earth. And the goal is to have that burn up over the Pacific Ocean. Right now, I believe it's still in orbit. Hasn't done that yet. But that was launched in November. That's a little over 8,000 pounds worth of food, clothes, science experiments, and eventually docked to the International Space Station. Northrop Grumman, when they launched these Cygnus spacecraft from Wallops Island, Virginia, on the Antares rocket, they always named the cargo vehicle after an astronaut, usually somebody that worked for NASA, an astronaut, or somebody that's been heavily, has died, and that's, you know, one of NASA's main people. In this case, they named it after Sally Ride. Sally Ride, you might remember, was the first American woman to travel to space on, STS-6. Right after it became operational. She was the first on a five-person crew. So they named it after her. It was, you know, she has passed on, and she died of pancreatic cancer some years ago. Sally Ride, Cygnus vehicle, separated from the space station, but before it did, NASA has been trying to use Cygnus to reboost space station. They tried it on 17 now, and they did it on 18, except for a longer period of time. You know, there's a lot of fuel left on these vehicles. What they plan on doing before they separate is orient the space station in such a way where Cygnus is docked, when they ignite their engines, for I think it was like 15 or 20 minutes, they're able to accelerate the whole station and get it into a higher orbit. You know, if they don't do this on a regular basis, that orbit could eventually decay. for decades now. They've used either the shuttle when the shuttle was operational to do that, and most of the time they use the Russian service modules or Progress vehicles that are attached to the space station. That was the main way of boosting the space station. Now, with problems with Russia and all, NASA says, well, they had plans of doing this anyway, but, you know, I think they accelerated those plans to use Cygnus to do just that. Well, that worked out okay. They did that, and they'll be doing it on every flight in the future. You know, they're still, they quote, certifying Cygnus to be able to do that. They'll be able to probably maybe bring more fuel up next time or whatever it is, but anyway, that's a new system that NASA has been doing. Things are separated and after that, and now it's on the way back with many thousands of pounds of trash and junk. A lot of stuff left over on the space station on a regular basis. They loaded it to the Cygnus. No science stuff, because that always has to come back on a Dragon vehicle. Right now, presently, that's the only one that could return cargo, either Dragon for people or Dragon for cargo. At least until they get Dream Chaser going, and that should be within a year or so. Dream Chaser will be able to bring cargo to and from the International Space Station. And someday in the future, people. But I think by that time, there'll be other new space station up there, either, you know, a private one, either by Amazon or actually our North government plans on putting one up as well. And another one that plans on having their own space station is Axiom. It might be three different space stations to choose from besides the International Space Station. But eventually they plan on deorbiting that thing. Present plans are 2030. Any comments? Okay, I'm getting toward the witching hour. Just wanted to mention, somebody asked me about when the first amateur radio contact
complete
was, you know, from space. So it was before the International Space Station. And it was on a STS-9, you know, Columbia mission. That was back in November 1983 with Owen Garriott. Owen Garriott, you know, he was one of the astronauts that flew to Skylab. Remember, Skylab had three different crew missions that went to that, and each time they went, they descended there in time and space. But throughout the whole Skylab mission, they did not have amateur radio on board that. But on a shuttle mission, STS-9, 1983, Owen Garriott was on board. His call is W5LFL. W5LFL. And Dick, H-U-R-I-W, our fearless leader from the 1980s, with this particular net to TechNet, used to talk about that. And sure enough, that he was one of the people that were able to make that contact early on. You know, Owen Gary has made many, many contacts going around the Earth, including one to King Jordan of the King of Jordan, one of them was K2RIW, and you can talk about that. If you go back to the old archives, every now and then they'll talk about Owen Garriott W5LFL contact from the space shuttle. Space Shuttle Columbia, by the way, which of course doesn't exist anymore. Anyway, we'll turn it back to Roy. This is the conclusion of the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And tomorrow night we'll be on for the club InfoNet is always on at 8:30. Listen into that. And that's always followed by Flop Shop and followed by Newswine in for that. Monday night's a busy TechNet. TechNet for, not TechNet, series of nets for LIMAC. Anyway, over to you, Roy. AC2GS, WS2N.
Okay, very good. This is AC2GS. Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do here on the TechNet. And thanks for all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it. I appreciate it especially. And I appreciated all the participation tonight. Some familiar voices I heard once again. So please come back in future. We're here every Sunday night starting at 8 p.m. And you're all welcome. As Dick used to end the technical net, be kind to each other. That's always good advice. I like to add a little line from Epictetus, a Roman philosopher. It's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So keep your mind open, and you never know where you're going to learn something. I learned some things tonight, and I hope you did as well. Have a great week. Be well. Stay safe. Have fun. Enjoy yourself. And please come back next Sunday night when we're going to do this all over again. Our rebels now are done. This is AC2GS, formally closing this episode of the Limar Technical Net, and I am clear.
N2KW from WB2BXO. Wonder if you're still around, Alan. N2KW from WB2BXO.
I don't hear him, Frank. I think he's gone. WS2N. Clear.
Yes, so, Paul. I'll shoot him an email at some point. Anyway, yeah, I guess you probably have to get up tomorrow. It's sort of free. Thanks for the great report. I guess Starship will give it another try in a couple of months. WB2BXO. Have a good night.
And no, I don't have to get up. I'm a retired steam footer, so thank goodness I don't have to get up. I get to watch all these space events.
That's interesting. I kind of assumed you did something in aerospace.
I wish. A lot of the contractors I worked for did work at Grumman quite a bit. So, I mean, that's as close as I got. But, which was a lot of fun talking to these guys. And then, you know, when I worked there, I used to tell everybody I'm going to chain myself to the column. I'm not leaving.
Hey, well, what can I say? You did the hard work and probably made more than, you know, most of us college boys and who, you know, I don't know, dump the desk all day. It sounds like you did some interesting stuff, though.
Yeah, oh yeah, like any job. We had good jobs and terrible ones. Grumman jobs were fun, and we had a bunch of buildings, of course, on the island. Bethpage and Calverton. And Brookhaven Lab. But, we covered into the city, so we did apartment buildings in the middle of nowhere. And big city, you know how it is. So, good and bad. But, a lot of fun. It was a 5-year apprenticeship. So. Unfortunately, it was a lot of school involved, which I actually like. Back to you, Brad.
Yeah, I know. I've seen some of the trades promoted as the other 4-year degree, 5 years. That's, that's as much training as most of us do, go to college or grad school. It's probably a little more than some of us do. That's quite a bit, but, sounds like you enjoyed yourself, though, and did some interesting things and some real practical stuff.
Oh, yeah. Got a problem with heating, air conditioning, welding.